And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us. Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn. Nice looking day out there. It's a little cool, but it's not bad. Yeah, sunshine makes up for a lot of coolness, doesn't it? And it's still April, after all. April 24th, although last week of April now. Yeah. Yeah, 1 week from today, next Wednesday is May 1st. Wow. Wow. Hey, we're going to get right to it today because we have several guests to chat with on the It's Your Turn program. We're going to be talking initially, in just a couple of moments, as a matter of fact, with Becky Lomax about visiting the national parks. There are about 60 of them across the country, national parks. And this is the time of the year when folks are thinking about vacations and getting away. Or maybe you're just interested in learning a little bit about the national parks. Well, we'll find out a lot about it with Becky Lomax. Also on the program today, there are some possible changes, some proposed changes for Medicare that seniors will be interested in. And we'll talk about that with Michael Seiden today. And then we'll discuss cybersecurity with Ray Rothrock. So all of that coming up on the It's Your Turn program today. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll hook up on the phone with Becky Lomax right after this word.
I can't remember the last time I went to the dentist. Now I'm too embarrassed to go because my teeth are in such bad condition.
Unfortunately, this person is not alone. Many folks put off going to the dentist because they fear being scolded for neglecting their teeth. This is Dr. Bob Todd with a special message. Dentistry today is faster, easier, and better than ever before. At our dental office, we don't believe in making you feel guilty, no matter how long it has been since you've seen a dentist. We know fear and embarrassment can cause a cycle of procrastination. If it has been years since you've been to the dentist, call us today. We will help put your mind at ease and bring your smile back to health.
If you hate going to the dentist but know you have a dental problem, help is only a phone call away. Dr. Bob Todd and his friendly dental team will answer all your questions and care for all your concerns. For complimentary information or to schedule an appointment at their Butler office on Evan City Road, please call 282-7774 or on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Good segment coming up, listeners, on the next part of It's Your Turn here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey, and we're going to be talking about the national parks across the United States with the author of a tremendous guidebook entitled USA National Parks. The author is Becky Lomax, and she visits with us by telephone here today. Becky, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us for a few minutes.
Thank you for having me.
I must tell you straight away that this is simply a gorgeous book. I have a review copy in my hand right now. It is, first of all, it's voluminous. It's well over 600, almost 700 pages. But it's small enough that, you know, you could easily fit it in a backpack or a suitcase, right?
Right, yeah, and that's the idea, is to help with your travel planning before you go and then take it along with you so you've got it to reference as you're in the parks.
And there are also hundreds and hundreds of color pictures in here. In fact, the whole guide is in color with the national parks visited by region across the U.S. By the way, as I look at the map in the front of your book, it seems that the vast majority of national parks are in the western half of the country. Is that true?
Well, that's true, yes. And so, you know, if you look at the Rocky Mountains, the Southwest, and then the Pacific coastal mountains, the Sierras and the Cascades, that's where the bulk of the parks are. And then outside of that, on the East Coast, you've got, you know, kind of a line of parks from Acadia down to Shenandoah, Great Smoky Mountains, and then down to the southern tip of Florida with Everglades. And then outside of the 48 states, you've also got U.S. Virgin Islands, American Samoa, a couple of two parks, national parks in Hawaii. They're both volcano parks. And then Alaska, of course, has tons of big parks.
Mm-hmm. Well, why the predominance of national parks in the West? Is that because there was so much federal government-owned land there at one time?
That might have had something to do with it, but the first national park that kind of prompted the whole idea of national parks in our country was Yellowstone. So that's out here in the West. And then I think as the West was being explored, then suddenly there were these other places, like, you know, really unique scenic places that people felt really needed to be preserved, like Yosemite and Glacier and Grand Canyon and Death Valley and so forth, and all of, you know, gradually more and more these special places got added to the list. And interestingly enough, I was just back in Shenandoah last week, and that park, one of the reasons or the push for getting Shenandoah started was specifically to get a national park in the East. And I thought that was so interesting that, you know, that was one of the original reasons there. And for, let's see, you guys are in Pittsburgh, that's a pretty, you know, a reasonable drive. It's about, I think, about 5 hours to get to Shenandoah.
If that long. It's a pretty direct route down I-79, at least close to it. So.
Yeah.
Now, how many national parks are there altogether? Do you know the grand total?
Well, there's actually 61 now. There's two more that were added right after we went to print. And so there's a new one up at... The newest one is Indiana Dunes, which is right on the southern tip of Lake Michigan. And the other one is the St. Louis Gateway Arch. And that one commemorates the start of the whole westward expansion of the country.
Mm-hmm. I was under the impression, obviously mistaken, that Gettysburg was a national park here in Pennsylvania. It must just be a...
Well, you know, it's a different type of national park, because if you talk about National Park Service units, there's well over 400 of those, and that includes national monuments, national historic monuments, national military parks, and, you know, on and on and on. What we were covering in this book is just strictly the ones that have the national park, that's it, title.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, are the quarters, the newly minted quarters that have been distributed for the past few years, they celebrate some of the national parks, do they not?
They do, yeah. When Glacier's, because I live right outside of Glacier, when the quarters came out with Glacier, I went and bought a few of them just so I'd have them.
I must say, I collected the state quarters, and that's quite a while back now. But I haven't made an effort to collect all of the national park quarters. I'm sure there are collectors.
I'm sure. Yeah, collectors getting those together.
Mm-hmm. Well, how was it that you came to write this book? You are actually the daughter of a national park ranger, right?
Yeah, my dad was a ranger before I was born in Mount Rainier National Park. And then he went on to become a Boeing engineer. But the whole time we were growing up, that's what we did as a family. We went to Mount Rainier and went camping and hiking. It's just what we did. And later in my life, I moved to Montana, right outside of Glacier National Park, and I became a hiking and backpacking guide in Glacier National Park. And so I was showing people, you know, taking them out on these wonderful trails and looking at wildlife, looking at geology, all kinds of fun stuff out there. And I really liked doing that. And when I was done with the hiking and backpacking guide thing, I decided, well, let's start writing about it. So that's when I did my first book, and it was a guidebook to a moon travel guide to Glacier National Park. And then since then, I've updated that book several times and gone also and done the Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks book, and then this is the most recent book that I've done, the USA National Parks.
I have been to Acadia National Park. It's on the shores of Maine. It's up a bit from the capital city of Maine, but it's gorgeous, certainly a gorgeous place. And that seacoast, that Atlantic coast of Maine, is absolutely fantastic, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. That's, and what's really cool about that park is you can actually visit it year-round. And as you, I mean, in winter, you can ski and snowshoe in there. And so it's one of those parks that just has such incredible variety of things to do, from whale watching, which is happening right now there, to hiking and kayaking, walking in the mountains, or just having tea at Jordan Pond House.
Obviously, you live in the West, and you grew up visiting national parks in the West. Can you tell us some of your favorites out there, or perhaps some of the ones that folks from our part of the country might want to visit someday?
Yes. I would say everybody needs to put the Grand Canyon on their list. To stand on the edge of the canyon and you're looking down 5,000 feet to the Colorado River below, it's just an amazing experience. And it's the type of place where you want to experience it from sunrise to sunset. And if possible, get into the canyon, because once you drop off the lip and start hiking down the trails or taking one of the mule rides down the trail, the whole view changes entirely and the whole experience changes. And you're walking through layer and layer and layer of geology and history, essentially, as you're going down.
Tell us how this guide can help people plan in advance for a trip, for a vacation.
Well, for one thing, it's divided into regional sections. So one of the things each one of those regional sections does is show you how to do road trips. So if you want to link up, say, 2, 3, or 4 parks in an area, it shows you how to do it, the mileage between those parks, roughly how long it'll take you to drive between each of the park, and that can help you plan your trip. And then when you look at the individual chapters for each park, that's when you can get into the nitty-gritty of, well, here's what I want to do here. I want to go on this scenic drive. I want to hike to this trail. I want to paddle this lake. I want to stay in this lodge, or I want to camp. It helps you know what options are in that park to be able to put pieces together that you would find interesting.
Yes, because all the parks are different. Some have camping, some do not. Some have swimming or bicycling or whatever, and others do not. And you detail all of this in your guidebook. It is really very thorough. What about places to stay? Do you talk about that in your guidebook?
Yes. We do cover all of the inside park lodges. So there's, you know, quite a few parks have these historic lodges, like Old Faithful Inn in Yellowstone, or, the Awani in Yosemite is one, Paradise Lodge in Mount Rainier. Those lodges are all covered in the book, so you can find out information on them. And in general, for planning, people want to try and get reservations for staying at those lodges a year in advance, and because they often book out. And then also, we have the camping inside the park covered. And for those parks that don't have inside park lodging or camping, we have a little bit mentioned in there about what's covered around the park. So where where would you stay just outside of the park to be able to access it?
You also,
and that information then you can use to help plan your whole trip.
I'm looking at the map and at your various chapters here, and I see another national park that would be certainly accessible to us here in western Pennsylvania, and that's the Cuyahoga Valley National Park. That's in our neighboring state of Ohio.
Yeah, and actually that one's probably the closest to Pittsburgh, I would say. And that one's cool because that one's got a lot of history with it because it's part of the canal system in Ohio. And one of the things that you can do there is it's got the towpath that they used to pull the barges up the canal between each of the canal locks. That towpath is 20 miles long along the river, and it's now turned into a bicycling and walking trail. And so you can walk just little sections of it, or you can bicycle the whole thing in a day if you'd like to.
Yes, I mentioned the thoroughness of Becky's guidebook. I've just turned to the map of Cuyahoga Valley National Park, and yeah, it just it kind of sandwiches the Cuyahoga River for about 22 miles. But you've got all the towns, you've got the trails all marked here. Very, very thorough.
And one additional thing that's fun in that park is there's actually the scenic railroad that goes down through the park. So you can ride the railroad down and back if you want, or you can bicycle one direction and put your bike on the train and take the train back up.
Many of the national parks are familiar to folks, at least they would know the name, certainly Grand Canyon, for example. Are there any hidden gems that people might not hear much about or even be aware of, Becky?
Yes, there are. One of my favorite kind of parks that is not on the popular let's have to go list is Theodore Roosevelt National Park. It's in North Dakota, and it is... The geology there is just beautiful. It's a series of badlands and river bottoms and eroded kind of mountainsides that is just gorgeous. Plus, it's got wildlife watching on par with Yellowstone. So when I was there last spring, we're camping, and here comes bison walking through our campground, and eagles are flying overhead, and just up the road there's a prairie dog town where the prairie dogs are running around in circles. We go to watch the prairie dogs, and here comes a pair of coyotes in to hunt the prairie dogs. Mm. And then about 5 minutes after the coyotes wandered off, here comes a herd of wild horses. So it was like everywhere we turned, we were watching wildlife there. It was phenomenal.
How did that come to be named after Teddy Roosevelt? As I recall from my history class, he was one of our first conservationists, was he not?
He was, and he was a big, huge park advocate. So that's part of the reason. But even more than that, he actually went to North Dakota and had a small ranch there. He loved the area right around Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and part of the park actually preserves his historic ranch land. And the house is no longer there or anything, but you can go to where he had his ranch, and it's right on the river there, and you can kind of see what he envisioned at one point.
From the size of your chapter on California, I have to think that it's one of the states that has the most national parks.
It does have a lot, doesn't it? Yeah, it's got everything from the redwoods on the coast and Channel Islands, to Death Valley, one of the hottest places in the country, and then Yosemite and Kings Canyon, you know, two incredible mountain parks. And then up north, it's got Lassen Volcanic National Park, so it's got one. If you don't want to go to Yellowstone and deal with the crowds there, you can go to Lassen Volcanic National Park and have some of the same type of scenery there, but without the crowds.
What's the biggest national park? Is it Yellowstone? It would have to be one of the biggest.
No, the biggest is actually up in Alaska, and it's Wrangell-St. Elias.
Ah, yes. I wasn't looking at my Alaska map here. I see it now. Looks like Death Valley.
Yeah, it's huge. It's something like 7,000, 8,000 or 8 million acres. What am I talking about? Millions of acres.
Looks like Death Valley National Park's pretty good, pretty big too. I didn't even realize that was a national park, Death Valley.
Yeah, it is. And that, interestingly enough, you know, people think it's just a valley. Well, it's got mountains around it. and some pretty impressive places that you can hike up to and get some incredible views. And then it's got also in it that Badwater Basin, it's got the lowest place in the United States. So you can actually, in national parks, you can go visit the highest place in North America, which is the summit of Denali in Denali National Park, or you can go to the lowest place, which is Badwater Basin in Death Valley. And it's something like 240 feet below sea level.
Everyone has heard of Yellowstone and Grand Canyon National Park and Yosemite, but it looks like the state of Utah has quite a few, too. And there are some very picturesque parks in Utah, Zion, Arches, some of the others.
Yeah. Bryce, Zion, Canyonlands, Arches, Capitol Reef, those are some of my favorites to go to. They're really best in spring or in fall. Summer can get pretty hot in those, and if that's the only time you can go, definitely still go. But they're really, really nice this time of year.
Another place that folks from our area could possibly drive to or certainly fly would be the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. That's in western North Carolina, I believe?
Yes, and Tennessee, too.
Oh, okay, right on the border.
And actually, that's the most visited national park in the whole system.
Really?
And so you got to be ready for having people when you go there. But you also can get away from people by getting off on some of the hiking trails and so forth. And you can hike up to, they're called balds, and they're some of the mountains where the tops are rocky and they don't have trees on them. So you can get up there, and because there aren't the trees right around the summit, you can get these wonderful, beautiful landscape views that take in the surrounding mountains and valleys.
And by the way, listeners, you can see some of these views that Becky's talking about, because there are some gorgeous color pictures scattered throughout the world. I'd hate to count them. There's got to be hundreds and hundreds of color pictures.
Yes, and they're I'm not the only photographer in the book. There's quite a few different ones. So, yeah, it's a wonderful collection of photos.
We're talking about the Moon Guide, the USA National Parks Guide, the complete guide to all 59 parks. I wanted to check on the map. You said you live on the edge of Glacier National Park. Oh, my goodness, Becky, that's right up at the Canadian border, isn't it? Wow.
Oh, yeah. We're about 30 miles as birds fly.
Does that park extend across the border into Canada? Is there a counterpart in Canada?
There is. It's called Waterton Lakes National Park, and they actually share the boundary, the northern boundary, and they also share Waterton Lake. Part of the lake is in the U.S., part is, in Canada there, mm-hmm. and so it spans both national parks. And together, they became the world's first international peace park.
Wow. Well, there is a peace bridge that connects Canada and the United States here in our area, so I can understand the name. Wow.
Yeah.
Very enlightening, folks, whether you're planning a trip, whether you want to revisit places that maybe you've been in the past, or if you just want to look at some beautiful pictures and learn a little bit about the history of our national parks, because there's a little history lesson, too, here about every one. By Becky Lomax. I knew a little bit about national forests. We have one of those here in Pennsylvania, the Allegheny National Forest.
Mm, but very well known, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But I learned a lot about national parks from the book. Becky Lomax is the author. She's been our guest. Again, the title is The Moon Guide, USA National Parks, the Complete Guide to All 59 Parks. Becky, a delight to chat with you. Thanks for being with us here today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. So long now.
All right. Bye-bye.
You've seen the hit show Dancing with the Stars. Now see your favorite Butler celebrities hit the dance floor for an evening of fun and fundraising. On Saturday, May 11th, the Butler County Symphony invites you to join them for Dance with Butler County Celebrities at the Days Inn. See ballroom dance performances by Commissioners Kevin Buzo and Leslie Oshie, BC3 President Dr. Nick Newpower, and Butler County Ford's Kathy Glasgow, and many more. Tickets are available for the Saturday, May 11th event at the Symphony office or at butlersymphony.org.
Pittsburgh commuters, are you tired of sitting in traffic while wasting all of your money on parking fees, wear and tear on your vehicle, and gas? Butler Transit is a commuter's choice from Butler County to Pittsburgh. BTA's chartered buses offer free park and ride locations, onboard Wi-Fi, and charging stations, and real-time bus location technology. Stop worrying about traffic, detours, and downtown parking. Catch a bus at a location near you. Visit butlertransit.com for daily schedules, mobile ticketing, and a stress-free commute.
Hi, this is Dave Malarkey. I'd like to talk to you for just a moment here about the good folks at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here at Butler. What a great job they do to help those who are less fortunate in many ways. They operate the St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, of course. They have their St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store in the Greater Butler Mart and their Client Aid Program. And the Client Aid Program helps needy families or individuals, you know, maybe with help on a heating bill or a rent payment at the end of the month. Client Aid. And that's funded through the operation of the thrift store. So you can help by donating items that you no longer need or want to the thrift store. It's very easy to do. Drop-off bins are right inside the door. You can use the container outside. They're located in the Greater Butler Mart. So think about it. Next time you're cleaning the closet or the upstairs, instead of throwing that stuff away, why not donate it to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler? We stand tallest when we stoop to help others. Listeners, coming up on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, I'm Dave Malarkey. We're going to be talking about Medicare. This will be of interest to seniors. There have been some recent proposed changes to Medicare that could have a widespread impact. Medicare was created back in the mid-1960s, a program to ensure that seniors have safe and affordable access to health care. However, some of the proposed changes to the program could impact access to medicine for seniors. Joining us now to talk about this, Dr. Michael Seiden. He's president of the U.S. Oncology Network. Doctor, can you tell us about some of these proposed changes to Medicare? What's up here?
Well, the administration has been interested in approaches to lower drug costs. And while we were in support of having affordable health care for all of our seniors, one of the changes they proposed, called the IPI program, looks to change the way seniors get access to IV medications. These are called Part B medications. These are medications that are typically used to treat serious life-threatening diseases such as cancer. And the proposal is to reset drug prices so that they are more closely aligned to the costs that these drugs are charged in foreign countries, 14 different countries in Europe and around the world.
So how would these changes impact how patients get access to these drugs?
Well, you know, I think the main thing that we're concerned about is it potentially impacts access for the patients. Now the physician can prescribe the drug he thinks or she thinks is best for the patient, can make the appropriate adjustments in the drug the day the patient comes in to be treated. In this system, the IPI system, they're inserting a third party, a vendor who's off-site to deliver the drugs for the Medicare patients. This will add another middleman into the process, will make access for the drugs to the patients a little bit more complicated, and may, in some cases, limit the ability of Medicare patients to have access to drugs they need in a timely fashion.
I just want to make sure I'm clear on this, Dr. Michael Seiden. I thought you mentioned a moment or so ago Part B. I thought that it was Part D of Medicare that had to do with drug access. Am I wrong on this?
So there are limitations on both Part B and Part D. Part B are the drugs which are typically given in a physician's office or in a hospital setting where the drugs are given usually intravenously. The Part D covered medications are the oral medications. Medicare has begun to put regulations or changes in how Medicare patients get Part D drugs as well, something where the Medicare Advantage plans can build more complicated formularies that make it more difficult for a physician to prescribe the drug he or she wants for a patient without going through a series of steps.
So if you're... Go ahead, doctor, please.
Yeah, I think in general we've been strong proponents to not interrupt the physician-patient relationship. We believe strongly that physicians should have the ability to decide which medications are best for patients. This is typically the way it works in most commercial plans for, you know, individuals who are not in the Medicare population. And we'd like to see that those same medical practices extend to the Medicare population as well.
So if you in the U.S. Oncology Network are concerned about this proposed these proposed changes by the administration, do you have any ideas yourselves on how we can reduce costs of drugs?
Yeah, thanks for asking, Dave. We've been involved and have been very strong partners with the Medicare program in looking at value-based care programs where we work with Medicare and with the patients we treat to try to control the overall cancer care costs. So this includes costs spent on drugs, use of emergency rooms in hospitals, and we are beginning to redesign our practices, extending hours, bringing in navigators, trying to identify vulnerable patients to reduce the risk that these patients end up in emergency rooms or hospitals. And we've demonstrated that we've saved Medicare millions of dollars by doing this. These programs take several years to implement and optimize. We're about 3 years into that journey. I think the new programs that the administration is considering would really derail a lot of those efforts that are well underway. And we've encouraged CMS and members of the administration to give us some additional time to continue to optimize these programs, because in the last 2 or 3 years, we've really seen results. And I will say that the patients in general in these value-based programs have very much appreciated the changes, meaning we've hired more individual social workers, navigators, and people to support cancer patients during the cancer journey. The changes we've made in these new programs have really been designed to provide a better patient experience. Some of the newer programs that have been proposed will be quite disruptive.
One final question, and a quick one, but a very important one, I think, Doctor. What can seniors do if they're concerned about these proposed changes by the Trump administration?
Yeah, I think it's important that the seniors reach out to their representatives in Congress and in the House and in the Senate and tell them that they'd like access to the medications that they need and to minimize the disruption physicians experience in delivering the best care for the patients in as timely a manner as possible. Restrictions that handcuff physicians or add to additional complexity in getting the patients the care they need really need to be discouraged.
Dr. Michael Seiden is president of the U.S. Oncology Network. Thanks, Doctor. Nice to talk with you today, sir.
Thanks, David.
Interesting information, isn't it, on proposed changes to Medicare? We'll see if any of that comes to fruition. Coming up later this week, just a couple of program notes for you. We're going to be talking with folks from Butler City Hall. on the Friday edition. It's a regular edition of City Hall. Also, we're going to be talking about an upcoming bicycle rodeo and about a blessing of the pets, an annual event here in the Butler area for many, many years. So those are some things to look forward to as we hit the final couple of days of It's Your Turn. And coming up in just a couple of moments, we'll meet our final guest of the day for today. We're going to be talking about cybersecurity. Are you prepared? Are companies prepared for cybersecurity threats for hackers from both this country and from abroad, as we've heard in the news in recent months? Ray Rothrock will be our guest. That's coming up here on It's Your Turn right after these words. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Only in the forest can you see this. And this. And this. But nothing beats the moment you see that. That's your child's eyes opening up to a world of possibilities.
I didn't know it could do that!
Because one trip to the forest can spark a world of difference.
There are some moments only the forest can inspire. Find yours at discovertheforest.org. Learn about forests near you and discover cool things to do when you go, like hiking, canoeing, fishing, or camping. Or create your own adventure with family and friends, and you might just see this. Your moment's out there. Find it at discovertheforest.org. That's discovertheforest.org.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Cybersecurity, listeners, is the next topic on It's Your Turn here on WISI today. I'm Dave Malarkey. We'll be chatting with Ray Rothrock. Ray, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us here today.
Nice to be here.
Cybersecurity. We hear a lot about it. It's in the news a lot. I suppose the first really big case that drew nationwide attention was that attack on Target several years ago where so many people with credit cards were endangered. Am I right on that?
You're very correct. It was a very popular conversation in the media, and actually it's what got me to join the company I'm at now, because I think it signaled a new era in cyber problems.
A little bit about Ray Rothrock. He is CEO and the chairman of Red Seal. That's a leader in network modeling and cyber risk scoring. And Ray, you were also a participant a couple of years ago in a summit at the White House on cybersecurity, right?
Well, it was at Stanford, but it was the White House was here, yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. So what did you talk about? How to make sure that you're as protected as you can be in case you try to get hacked?
Well, you mean at the summit or with the book?
Yeah, at the summit and the book,
summit, actually. The summit was a whole lot about just bringing industry attention to compliance and government regulations and such. That was, you know, a couple of years, it was after the Target, but a couple of years before the cloud really began to take over. So there was this sort of interim step. It was an acknowledgement at the most senior level in the political world that cyber is a national concern and one that we all need to pay attention to. That was really the goal of it, and it was quite good at doing that.
Do you think the leaders of most companies think that they understand their threats, but maybe really don't?
Well, yeah, that's probably mostly true. I think it's gotten a lot better, a lot faster than it used to be. Most of the leaders in companies, of course, they depend on their teams to do whatever they got to do. But the real bit flip, I call it, is we went from a world of we thought we could put up, you know, protection, high walls, firewalls, all kinds of things to keep the bad stuff out. And what Target said, or what Target demonstrated, was the bad software, the malware, was already in our well-protected corporations. And that was an aha moment for a lot of people, and it's been a slow but steady and now accelerating that meme as a CEO, or anybody as a big company CEO, is a problem, and they need to deal with it differently than they used to.
I know you talk about the Target incident in your in your book. What exactly happened there to Target, by the way?
Oh, it's something that could happen to anyone, and that's what makes it so relevant to us all. So Target is a Fortune 50 company, I believe. They've spent a lot of money on cybersecurity products. They have excellent engineers, teams, and policies. And what happened was a third-party supplier, someone in their supply chain, a fellow came to work on their air conditioning system, and he hooked his laptop into their air conditioning system to do standard routine stuff. Well, earlier, he had been phished, P-H-I-S-H, if you know what that is. I'll get to that in a minute. But he had been phished, and malware had been deposited on his computer. When he connected to Target, it hopped into the Target network and started marching around looking for credit card information. And it took it some time, but that's what these robots do, these malbots. And it found it at the cash registers of the Target stores. Now, you can imagine how long it might have taken and how it got there and how it really shouldn't have gotten there, but it did. And when it found it, the way these bad programs work, they phone home. It's called command and control. And it phoned home and said, I found what we're looking for, and it starts sending it out. And it's a very simple thing. Someone outside the corporation came in with malware quite unintentionally and contaminated it, and the malware took over. Now, Target, the real key for them was they had appropriate alarm systems, and the alarms were going off. But management, at the end of the day, this was the Christmas season, if you recall, 2013, they said, we got to let it run because we can't shut down our revenue source. And they let it run, and, of course, 40 million customer records were removed from Target. And it cost them their jobs, and Target got a big black eye. But it made all of us in the business say, that's a different kind of problem. And that's the story of Target.
I can't believe that was over 5 years ago. Wow, time flies. Huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Was anybody ever prosecuted for that? Did authorities ever find out who the bad guys were?
Absolutely. They figured all that out. They figured out where the software had come from and the phishing attack, and they traced it all down. No one was ever prosecuted. I mean, these were actually non-U.S. People that created the software that caused the problem. But the people at Target lost their jobs, the CEO and the CSIO and all the other senior executives, because they made a bad management decision, even though they had appropriately thought they were safe.
You mentioned phishing earlier,
yes.
Ray. Define that for listeners who may not know what you're talking about.
That's a good one, and it's an important one because about 95% of the successful attacks, that is one that where data is actually exfiltrated from a corporation or a network or a home, starts with a phishing attack. And phishing is sending you an email that looks, first of all, it's from somebody you know or an organization you know, your bank, your healthcare provider. Just amazing how they can get that kind of personal information. It looks very much like an official email. You respond to it, and it says something like, we need to verify your password, or we need to confirm something. And you click on a link, and as soon as you click on that link, it takes you to a website that is not really Bank of America or somebody like that. It's a fake website, but it looks just like Bank of America. And as you sit there, it puts software down on your computer, and if you so happen to type your password in the field it's asking for, you've now given up your credentials. It's, by the way, phishing is as old as humans. Benjamin Franklin used phishing back in the Revolutionary War to get people to do things, writing official-looking paper letters and sending them to people. You can imagine. It's a form of deception, and it works. And most all of our cyber trouble starts with a phishing attack.
And so the theory is you can try this 1,000 times, and if you only get one hit, well, then that's worth it, I guess, huh?
Absolutely. And we got, you know, seriously, at my company, my employees, there's only 155 of us, every week, one or two or three gets a phishing attack, which looks like it's from me. And we've now put filters up and trained people. You can now train on this stuff, how to detect it. You know, it's, and it says, you know, hey, Stephanie, please wire, you know, $2,000 to this account. I need to make a payment on behalf of the company. It looks very official, but it's not me.
We're talking with Ray Rothrock. He's written a book entitled Digital Resilience. Is your company ready for the next cyber threat? I'm sure much of the material, much of the information in your book, Ray, could also apply to individuals as well, private citizens, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I wrote the book. It's not a technical book at all. What I try to do with the book is relate our physical world to the experiences we're having in the cyber world. So I talk about undersea cables. I talk about libraries. I talk about networking in the sense that we're all tied together. You know, what happens in your neighborhood might happen to you, kind of thing. And I try to relate it to that. And then in the book, at the end of each significant piece of it, there's a little lesson learned here. If you don't read the story of how or why I showed that lesson, here's the lesson. So there's little takeaways all through the book. You can read the book in 20 minutes, or you can read the book in 2 hours.
How can you identify weaknesses in your cybersecurity system? Are there programs for that, or what do you do?
Yeah, if you're a corporation, there are simulations. It's called penetration testing, and you can in fact run these. I run them on my corporate network at Red Seal, and it tells you where your vulnerabilities are. Actually, the software that we make does that for you automatically, and we give you a score. That's why risk scoring is a very important thing today. What people never talked about scoring. People just assumed your cyber was good 5 years ago. Today, boards are asking their CEOs, who are asking their teams, can you prove to me, can you show me a number, can you give me numbers? That's what boards understand is numbers. That says we're getting better or we're getting worse or what we can do about it if it changes. And so my software is all focused on giving senior management those things. So, yes, is the answer to your question there.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that the bad guys in the Target incident of more than 5 years ago were actually outside the United States. Is that becoming more and more common, or do we still have mostly domestic hackers?
It's hard to say. Of course, the famous Sony attack, or the infamous Sony attack, was identified as North Korea. The WannaCry that was a couple of years ago came out of Eastern Europe. But there are plenty of hackers in the United States. It doesn't matter. That's part of the political and legal issue is, if you find them in the United States, you can do something about it. If you find them in Eastern Europe, what does our country do? And so part of what has been talked about at the highest levels of government, the White House, is we need an international consortium, if you will, of how we're going to deal with these, because all of us are, of course, subject to it. Well, if you're a bad state actor, like North Korea, do you want that? Of course you don't. So it's a complicated international problem.
It's a scary thing for a lot of businesses and for a lot of people, too, because you know, they feel like they don't quite understand it, and therefore it becomes all the more threatening, you know?
Yeah. Well, there are things you can do as a person. I actually, as I've been talking to folks like you, Dave, and many others, I usually get the question, well, what can an individual do? So I wrote a whole another chapter, and I put it online on my website, redseal.net, so you can download that. But basically, the number one thing is learn to recognize phishing email. You can go online and get trained up yourself. Use two-factor authentication if you're doing sensitive things like talking to your bank or paying bills or whatever. Don't just use simple passwords. And if you do use simple passwords, change them. Change them often. And most importantly, keep all your gear, keep all your software and stuff up to date. I know it's a hassle, it's a pain, but that's how generally the cyber fixes get built into our technology, is through these updates, and it's really important that you keep doing that.
You mentioned two-factor identification, so that means not just a password, but you know, identify this picture or
that part of it. Or in my case, my bank. So when I log into my bank, they always send me a text on my phone, and then I put that text. There's a code in that text, and I put it back in, and therefore it locks that conversation and completely encrypts it and secures it. So I've identified myself through my name and password, and then also through this code that comes not on the computer but on my telephone.
A little bit of a hassle, but certainly worth it in the long run.
Yeah, I'm sure we thought that carrying a bunch of keys in our pocket to keep our doors locked was a hassle, too, but we got used to it. We'll get used to this one, too.
Speaking of keys and locks, what about this, and I'm sure most folks have seen this, the closed lock or the open lock logo up in the corner of a screen when you're dealing with the, certain websites. Is that really work? Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's yes, it is. In the web, the early days, it was, you know, this protocol called HTTP. I'll spare you the technical. And then Netscape came along and they created HTTPS. So it means secure, and it's encrypted traffic, and it's very highest level of encryption, and it tells you whether or not your communication with your whoever you're doing stuff with is locked or not. It's a very important thing, and I won't even do business if I don't see an HTTPS lock. It's just too risky.
Hmm. That's interesting. I've wondered about that because it seems so simple, you know, that that locked logo, open or shut, pops up, and I'm thinking, I wonder if they've hacked that too, you know?
Well, you know, there's that possibility, right? But, you know, you just got to think twice before you do things. That's one of the other things. If you get a phishing email and you think, you know, it's from your brother-in-law and it says, hey, you know, Ray, I need you to come or do this or whatever online, it's like, just delete it if you're suspicious. And chances are they'll never come back because like you say, they're sending out millions of these things. They're just looking for one person to fall for it. And if it's really your brother-in-law, he'll get mad at you and pick up the phone and call you and say, Ray, why the heck didn't you do that? And then I know it was real. But it's better to be safe than sorry. And that's really the mode of operating we all have to be thinking about these days.
And we have to be careful not just on a PC at home or in your study or whatever, but on your smartphone, too, because in reality, that's a small computer, you know.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is a computer. Phone is just it's because we've used them for phones. But mine's way more than a phone. So,
Have you ever experienced when you're online getting this screen that suddenly says, you know, your computer is locked and, call this number right away to unlock? That's happened to me.
I have, and I just delete it. It's usually a threat to try to get you to do something. I've had emails that suggest even worse. We have videos of you doing certain things, and you need to, wire some money or Bitcoin some money to me, and I just delete it. I'm like, interesting, but just delete.
Can this bad stuff be distributed through things like Facebook and Instagram and so on too?
Absolutely, through photographs. Sometimes an attachment to an email will be a picture or something, and it's a phishing attack. And if you click on it to look at it, you've released the software. But it's impossible to detect them all because you kind of got to know what you're looking for before you can detect it. However, things do change on your computer, and there's software. I know Symantec's got some really effective software that suddenly sees new activity in your CPU and the electronics on your machine. They'll say, something bad just changed, or something just changed. I don't know if it's good or bad. You want me to fix it? And you say, yes.
Do people need to change their passwords on a regular basis?
As often as you're comfortable with. Of course, the problem is, like, I have 280-something different passwords. So there are things called password managers out there now. They're very good. They live in the cloud. They cost nothing, $50 a year. And you can store your passwords. You can store sensitive information. They get hacked. They get attacked. So far, they've withstood the worst attacks. But I use one of those. I could never keep, you know. And the other thing, not only change your passwords, but you don't want to use the same password at all your sensitive places, like your bank, your doctor, your healthcare provider, whatever. You want different passwords because if a hacker is successful at getting some big database like it. Remember Equifax last year? Now I've got all these credentials about people, and my computers will automatically try to log into everything I can with your credentials, and that's not going to be cool. So not only change it, but don't use the same one for your most important thing.
and make your password somewhat complex, right?
Well, yeah, you know, that's an interesting one, Dave. I've read some interesting academic research, and yes, as complex and long as possible, but it turns out if you just take three words, three ordinary words, and just put them in your password with a dash or a slash or something in between, like, you know, Portola, Stanford, Dave. That Dave's too short, but, you know, 8-7-8-letter words, it's a lot easier to remember, and it's just as effective as these complicated things that you were referring to. So there's ways to make it better for you.
Getting back to the corporate world, something that you say Target did not do, respond to any exploits very swiftly and very effectively, right? Don't wait on it.
Oh, yeah, don't wait. Time is your enemy. In fact, this is a big problem in corporations. These attacks are slow rolling, if you think about it. But when it happens and when your alarm bells go off, it can take weeks, if not months, to really deal with it from an electronic point of view. It'd be as if you're at home, your house catches on fire, you dial 911, and 2 weeks later the fire department shows up. That's kind of our state of technology right now in a corporation is. So it's very important to have what they call rapid response teams. When the alarm bell goes off, you send in your egghead engineers to go solve the problem. We don't have enough of those people. The world is starving for that talent. And there are ways, and there's a lot, and I'll tell you, just a sidebar, if I were you know, not going to go to college, if I was going to be a skilled guy, we need plumbers, carpenters, and painters in the cyber world. And there are places where you can go get those certificates, and they're great jobs, and you're going to have a job for life. It's not going to be AI'd out of here. It's going to be a job that you can use and keep forever. So we need more of those kinds of people.
Is there any federal agency that is overlooking all this stuff, you know, like the Food and Drug Administration or the FCC or something like that? Or is it up to individual companies to monitor things?
Yeah, excuse me. Well, each agency has their own cyber group, but they all look to the Department of Homeland Security, who has really taken the role of modeling. Of coming up with compliance and things, and when a directive comes out of the government to the agencies, it usually comes from DHS. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, has published many things that a lot of our agencies use. It's quite good. And then MITRE Corp. Has burst on the scene. They've been a long-time government contract, but they've burst on the scene with some very good things about measurement, which is just starting to take hold, and I think that will change the game dramatically for our federal agencies. So, yeah, DHS is kind of the leader, but everybody, this is one of the concerns I have. We don't have a centralized policy thing that we really need. And in a world where regulation is not a popular word, we actually do need some in cybersecurity.
And one hopes that, engineers working around the clock to improve security, because, you know, doing stuff online, it's the wave of the future, Ray. I don't have to tell you. There are here in Pennsylvania, we're seeing more and more banks, for example, that are closing their, you know, their branches, their bricks and mortar store, and it would appear that at some point, perhaps not too far in the distant future, most financial stuff will be handled online.
Certainly, we are in a technological digital revolution, some people call it. So that's one element. The other element is software is in everything. Look at the Boeing situation with the 737 MAX. Software is everywhere. I drive a Tesla. I get a software update every couple of weeks. So this is just the way of our world. And so we better get used to it and better learn to do. Just like, you know, you learn to, I joke about it when I'm giving talks and lectures. It's like, remember when your mother taught you to clean your fingernails and wash your hands and comb your hair? Well, there's a similar thing in the cyber world. Change your password, update your software, and be smart.
Ray Rothrock, one of the nation's most recognized experts in cybersecurity, speaking with us, and the author of Digital Resilience. Is your company ready for the next cyber threat? Thank you, Ray. Good stuff. Very informative. Thanks for chatting with us here today.
You bet, Dave. Thank you very much, and have a great rest of the day.
And you too. So long now.
Righto. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.
Bushy blonde hairdo, serving USA. You'll catch them surfing at the
inside, outside
Ventura
USA.
County line,
inside, outside USA.
Santa Cruz and
Trinidad, inside, outside USA.
Australia, Caribbean,
inside, outside USA.
All over Manhattan,
inside, outside USA.
And down Bohemian Way,
inside, outside.
Everybody's gone surfing,
serving USA.
We'll all be planning out a route.
Ooh,
we're gonna take real soon.
Ooh,
we're waxing down our surfboard. We can't wait for June.
Ooh,
we'll all be gone for the summer.
Ooh,
we're on safari to stay.
Ooh,
tell the teacher we're serving,
serving USA.
Ooh, and Anchorage,
inside, outside, USA.
Pacific Palisades,
inside, outside.